Welcome to the Ashes preview episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast with more excitement than a Glenn McGrath Ashes prediction. Yeah, I can see Toby was looking forward to that.
That was particularly fine.
We're going to start with a preview. We'll be openly honest that this will be a slightly token preview this week, given that the only thing anyone really cares about this week is events at the Gabba in Brisbane. We'll start with New Zealand in India, and a certain amount of smugness here, because we sort of called this quite accurately last time, didn't we?
In a podcast that hasn't actually gone up yet.
Right, in a podcast that you'd have to be quite... you'll have to have access to Toby's laptop.
You'll also have to believe us that we haven't actually made the podcast in which we look very prophetic.
Well, actually, we weren't prophetic, because what we said was that there is no way New Zealand can be competitive unless all their batsmen perform in some way, which is kind of what's happened. Kane Williamson on debut, 131 in India. You kind of feel like it's quite exciting having a New Zealand cricket prodigy. You sort of feel like you should get cricket prodigies on Australia, cricket prodigies in South Africa. New Zealand doesn't feel like it sort of deserves a cricket prodigy, but it appears to have one. 20 years of age, this boy, and yeah, what a debut. Brendan McCullum, a double 100, Jesse Ryder 100, and then the fact that Tim McIntosh, who even the name gives thoughts of like severe mediocrity, chipped in with 100. I mean, everyone was helping themselves.
Everyone was helping themselves, but you do slightly wonder when Harbhajan makes as many runs as he did, whether this is rather because you're paying on a... Harbhajan came out with the immortal quotation, the chap who prepared one of the pitches should be given a contract making public highways for the Indian state.
Rahul Dravid, who, as we know, you know, without a doubt a great player, came out with a comment that we may be looking at the new Gary Sobers in Harbhajan. So perhaps it's not the pitches, but in fact the fact that Harbhajan has long been underrated, successive hundreds. The one thing we did say in that last episode is we said if we're going to take India seriously as a number one, then we are going to have to see them actually dominate this Australian team, properly hammer them. And that hasn't really happened.
Dominate this New Zealand team.
What did I just say?
You said an Australian team.
Sorry.
They're easily mixed up, actually. Young, pretty poor sides.
Well, we'll get on to that. I think however much we're going to be slagging off Australia this evening, that's probably stretching it. But they certainly haven't done it. It looks like this podcast, in terms of timing, may be very convenient for the Ashes, but very inconvenient in terms of everything else. But it certainly looks like New Zealand are going to take a pasting in this third test. But frankly, to have scored as many runs as they have, come out 1-0. And for Chris Martin, tell me something about your love and your views of that... that great seamer.
The great Chris Martin, who is more renowned for having a namesake in Coldplay than for his own bowling.
I'm quite surprised you're aware of
him. Signs of misspent youth. He seems to have been around for a hell of a long time, and he is nigh on 36, I think, isn't he? Either nigh on 36 or 35. Just for him to have... I mean, he's always been a competent bowler. But for him to have turned in that bowling display where he took 5 for not very many...
Not very, 5 for 60-odd, I think. And you look, it was one of those things. You woke up, you looked at Crick Info, and you honestly thought, India 80 for 6, Chris Martin with a 5-for. Of any bowler in world cricket to run through an Indian top order with Sehwag and co, he's not the obvious name. So it was not a series. And it was a good advert for Test cricket, in that you had a series that was supposed to be extremely one-sided, and then Chris Martin happened along with.
And it's quite difficult to decide whether it was just the Indians cocking it up and not being as good as they have seemed to tell us that they are, or whether it was just a New Zealand side who were just giving it a go.
Well, they certainly, I think they had that underdog mentality. They went for it. The other thing we said last time, the other Indian bowlers had to chip in. It had to be less about Zaheer. It had to be less about Harbhajan.
And it wasn't at all.
It hasn't really been.
No,
Zaheer and Harbhajan carried the majority of the burden. All this being said, if India have a great series in South Africa, a lot of this will be forgiven. So, moving very swiftly onwards to events in Sri Lanka, where Chris Gayle stopped being captain and started being rather successful.
A batsman.
Yeah, started being a batsman.
I always knew there was a Gooch in him somewhere. it was a quite remarkable innings. He's obviously a man absolutely brimming with talent, as so many of these West Indians are. But actually, to produce an innings of that length and that magnitude is to keep on, you know, once you get to 150, carry on to 200, and just that actual turnover is actually very, very difficult.
It was surprising to see him. You get the feeling with Chris Gayle that he could produce an innings like that almost any day of the week, but that there's almost a lack of effort, a lack of commitment. I mean, how many times do you see him make 40 and 30 balls in a test match and then get out stupidly? And the fact that he just went on and on in this, and he showed a lot of patience. I mean, a lot of the time, this wasn't runnable stuff. This was pretty plodding stuff, and he stuck with it.
And do you think do you think it's directly related with him being relieved of the captaincy?
I just wonder if there is crept in a kind of what the hell mentality to his game. He's lost, I think, a lot of respect within the game about the way he's treated the West Indian Test team. But I mean, at the end of the day, how better a way to answer it? He's come in and he's given the new captain, and you know, disappointing for the West Indies that they weren't able to win the game, but what a creditable result. I mean, to go to Sri Lanka, they dominated the game. It's tending to say, but even Gayle aside, there were some promising performances. There were the odd 50 made. Less said about perhaps the captain himself performance than the best.
It's quite interesting actually across the board how New Zealand and West Indies, two teams that, you know, it's very tempting to be quite pessimistic about, have actually come out and put in some pretty creditable displays.
Yeah, and good for the game as well. I mean, very
cricket. Cricket's the winner.
Deeply, deeply cliched. But I think to see this West Indian team go there and be competitive, because frankly, a Sri Lanka West Indies series didn't sound that appealing. You had a Sri Lankan team that looked like it would be very, very dominant. I hope for Darren Sammy that his personal game picks up, because I think he finished with wicketless and runless from this. And I think, much as you can make that argument, oh, he's a captain, a lot of pressure, la la la, a limit to how long that's going to... He suddenly looks like he becomes a bit of a passenger in that side. But maybe, making a prediction based on very little evidence here, I think that series might become actually a bit of a cracker. Mm. I look forward to seeing next two tests there. I think it'll be quite lively. If we've been slightly rapid and cursory so far, let's be very rapid and cursory about Pakistan, South Africa. Drew the first test. Well done, Pakistan. Anything you'd like to say?
Well done, Pakistan, slightly, but you do get the sense that they could have got more out of it. I mean, there's this kind of lethargy that's overtaken Pakistani cricket, apart from...
I thought you were going to say you do get the sense it might have been fixed. I was
about to say this lethargy you get a Pakistani cricket.
No way
the lethargy other than when they're running down to the bookmakers. I'm not sure I'm allowed to say that.
Our millions of listeners in Pakistan are burning your lethargy as we speak.
We've just lost that core audience. It was slightly disappointing on the last day when they could have pushed on. I mean, in the end, they came to sort of too comfortable a draw. I mean, how many wickets were they down at the end? I mean, not very many. Three or four, weren't they?
They were three or four down. They had players there and players in reserve. It would have been great to see them make a go of it. And if they nicked it, it would have been a fantastic win for a country that, you know, again, without wishing to be too cliched about it, for a country that could probably do with the lift. Yep. You know, for a game that's been so maligned there.
And in a sense, they could have gone for it without risking the match. I mean, it wasn't a case of just flinging the bat and throwing their wickets away or winning it, or just dead batting as they sort of did. They could. I mean, it wasn't an impossible target. I mean, it was a kind of...
On a slightly unrelated note, I'm being left none too inspired by this whole cricket in Dubai thing. It's not... I know it's not anyone's choice.
The day the ICC moved their offices there was a sad one for them.
You sort of feel like it would be rather more exciting if we played these... If we're having these sort of almost neutral tests, I'd love to see them be a bit bolder. Like, why not have these going on somewhere in the States? Mm. You know,
Because no one would go to them?
Well, I don't think that many people are going to the... I will need to check my figures. Attendances have not been stunning in Dubai. I can't really see the point. Pakistan can't play at home. We all know the reasons for that. This is all a bit... It's a little bit limp.
It is, and I think the Pakistan matches over the summer in England actually worked very well. Being at a neutral ground doesn't mean that it needs to be neutral in terms of having a passionate crowd or anything else in that sense. And I think maybe going to the US is a little step too far. But I think
why not? Let's be bold. Let's be brave. Let's take cricket into new
breakers. Break into brave new worlds. Yeah.
No, Dubai is not a particularly interesting place.
It's interesting,
it has no sort of cricketing heritage. La la la. Anyway, we have Ashes things to talk about.
Certainly do. So we're going to start our preview of the Ashes, not by looking forward, as most previews probably should start, but by looking backwards. Our From the Archives feature this week is...
A thriller.
Anyway, we'll get on to the thrilling part of it. The closest match, the closest Ashes match in Australia 50 years ago was the 58-9 Ashes. Run through, particularly the first match at Brisbane at the Gabba. It was a great England side. They were world beaters. They'd held the Ashes since 1953. Jack Fingleton famously said that they could have beaten an all world 11 pretty comfortably. So England go down under to defend the Ashes. Everyone thinks they're going to be comfortably victorious. It's Richie Beno's first captain as test as captain even for Australia. England go down at the first test at Brisbane at the Gabba. You can imagine huge expectation. What are this great England side going to do?
We might as well start even at this early stage. Lots and lots of parallels to be drawn. Yep. England team going there, lots of cockiness, lots of confidence. I think even the most optimistic England fan wouldn't say that this current England side are sort of indisputed world beaters. But lots of confidence and a sense that England are the team that's going to win.
And let's hope the parallel goes no further, because this England side in 1958 were bolder. Out on the first morning in under 4.5 hours. They won the toss and for some bizarre reason decided to bat on a pitch that had a little hint of green on it, and it was slightly overcast. But still, being bowled out in 4.5 hours on the first morning of the Ashes is... you think Harmison's momentary lapse was bad, but I think that probably caps it all. And it might be worth just quickly running through this England side and the players in it. We're talking Graveney, Mayers, Carson, Colin Cowdrey, Trevor Bailey, Godfrey Evans, Locklaker, and Statham are the bowling attack. It's a pretty phenomenal England lineup
in the spin department.
So in 58, England get bowled out for 134 in 4.5 hours. Australia go out, sod's law, the sun comes out, the pitch dries out. And they sort of make hay, but England managed to claw it back. And actually, Australia only reached 186, so they have a lead of just...
So, in fact, they make a fairly limited amount of hay.
They make a fairly limited amount of hay, not enough for a harvest. And they end up only with a lead of 52. And you think England have a little bit of momentum, and you think, right, okay, so England can get back into this match. It's been disastrous, they can get back into it. But what they do is actually quite staggering, and we're sort of still trying to get our heads around what kind of tactical reason there could have been for this. Just to quickly run through the scorecard, the number of runs and the number of balls taken to get those runs by each batsman. 8 off 43, 17 off 61, 68 off 427 balls, 36 off 169 balls, 28 off 138 balls are the pick of the England.
This is a spectacle. Would have been... I personally, and maybe a rare audience in this, would pay a lot of money. I think this would be thrilling stuff, watching an England side go out there and just pig-headedly dead bat for prolonged periods of time. I think it would be quite astonishing stuff. Because even given the time, this was, even given the period, like lower scoring stuff, this would still have been exceptional stuff. I mean, your average Aussie would have been choking on his latter day equivalent of Victoria Bitter at the sight of this.
And actually, Trevor Bailey was the pick of them. He scored 68 of 427 balls, and he scored off 40 of the balls he faced, which makes Chris Tavare and David Steele that seem like some kind of reckless buccaneers.
Exactly.
And so England just go out and they just sort of piss everyone off, really, and they only make 198, but they take 128 ball overs to make 198. I mean, which is really quite staggering.
And also for a team that go there as favourites, I mean, what a way to play.
They go there as favourites, but also they've just found themselves miraculously back in this match that they thought they were out of, and they just go out and dead. But anyway, the rest of the match is sort of just as boring, really. You think that England might have a chance. Australia only need to make 150-ish, but England have got two great spinners in Locke and Laker, and the pitch is deteriorating, and the storm clouds are supposedly coming in. But in the end, Australia
actually,
get there
getting
pretty.
Getting 150 already would be a challenge. Mm. Even today.
It would have been. But what Australia go out and do is a debutant batting at number four comes out and scores a pretty quick fire 71, and what's so interesting about this match, apart from just the sort of the sheer ridiculousness and comedy value almost of it, is just that you sort of get the sense of an England team that just sort of completely failed to read the rhythms of the match and to actually to be able to adapt to what was needed at that particular time. And it's something that's quite symptomatic of that whole series, because there are lots of little turning points within the whole series. The Australian bowlers are accused of chucking quite extensively. There are some bad umpiring decisions that go against England, etc., etc. And this just gets England more and more down, and they just don't have the kind of flexibility to respond to all of these things. Yes, it's a team of greats, but it's a team of greats who have been, most of them, playing for 20 years.
Well, for an England fan, it's a fairly depressing story, because it's rarely does an England team have the luxury of going down to Australia as favourites. Mm. I mean, you know, that's
significant favourites.
Well, exactly. I mean, that is something of a luxury. I mean, I wonder, and you can obviously overplay the historical comparisons. I mean, what I think is the most interesting thing here is the speed at which a series can get away from you, I think, when you're playing away from home. And you have an England team that go there, so much going for them. And you can almost argue that within a few hours, they had opportunities, obviously, to get back into it. But within a few hours, the momentum is gone.
Yep.
You know, suddenly, within a few hours, they are the team under pressure. Mm. They are the team...
And unless you're quick enough to actually respond to that and to be able to say, this is how we need to grasp momentum back, it's very easy, actually. I mean, this ridiculous innings where they did nothing but defend was exactly their way. Just, it just destroyed their momentum completely.
It's fascinating where that sort of comes from. I mean, to go out and play in that way, something had clearly happened. I mean,
They were only 30 behind on the first innings, but yet they play the most defensive innings, you know. I mean, I don't have the stats, and I'm not sad enough to have looked them up or worked them out. But I mean, it must surely be one of the slowest ever Test innings.
Mm.
The whole team.
Well, I mean, they almost deserve. I mean, in terms of the patience on show, I rather like the story about how Bailey finally went.
When he finally skips down the wicket, and once he scores his 68 or 427 balls with just four fours out of 427 balls, he just sort of gets a bit fed up and just skips down the wicket and is bowled by one of the Australian spinners.
That much concentration, surely you back yourself to go on and get 100. But I also quite like the fact that this is a sort of a young, hungry Australian team. And if we're gonna draw let's draw an optimistic parallel. We've got an England side, we've got an Australian team here that of the two, neither's a youthful team, to be honest, of the current generation, but perhaps an Australian team that even more has aging issues. In their top order and whatever, perhaps scraping the barrel a little bit here, but you know, the idea of a young side sort of beating the kind of older master, I think, is quite fun. Let us slip unless you have anything wonderful to add.
Well, I'm just wondering. Talking of seam.
Yeah.
That was seamless, you see, from your seam. I'm just wondering whether we should talk a little bit more about the GABA where this match played, and just the fact that this first match is a result wicket.
I think this idea, the GABA as sort of a place in legend, it's a place with a bit of aura, this idea that this is a place where Australia don't lose. And you wonder how much that plays on the visiting team's mind. But I mean, practically, I think you made a good point. If the consensus seems to be, if a wicket's going to have life in Australia, it's going to be this one. As an England fan, you're kind of like, well, bring it on.
Yeah.
You know, that's
the closest to Headingley we can get in the Southern Hemisphere would be a wonderful thing.
You can't help feeling that the more wicket, the more life in any wicket here is going to play to England more than it'll play to Australia. We have definitely completed the seamless transition into the Ashes preview part of the show, which we are going to do in quite thrilling fashion by plunging into the Ashes future, by looking at a series of what ifs.
5-0 at the end, I think, is the Ashes future, isn't it?
5-0, obviously, 5-0 England is the dream. But we're going to start with England's worst-case scenario. I take you to Wednesday night, or even Thursday morning in Australian time, and it's the first day at the GABA. Say we get an edge to Swan in the slips. He makes a hash of it. He breaks both his fingers on the first. Both his fingers, I mean, he has 10, several of them, but he breaks two fingers on his right hand on the first day at the GABA. What happens next? I'm going to say, position of ultra pessimism, I think it's all over. A fingerless Swan, and I think England are truly, they've lacked the joker in the pack, their MasterCard, all these things, he's gone. And suddenly the confidence will go within the camp, their ability to get 20 wickets, I think, goes.
But I think you have to look at the alternative as well, which is Panesar. It's all too easy to forget in the horrors of 2006 that when Panesar came in the third test, he took a 5 on debut, in his debut innings at the Wacker, and even Shane Warne has never taken a 5 at the Wacker. Yes, I agree. With Swan, you're losing a lot. You're losing a very, very useful level-order batsman. You're losing a good fielder. You're using, more than anything, a useful spinner. You're losing a talisman for the England side.
Well, I think this is my feeling, that he's become more than that. He's become the Flintoff, the Botham of the side. He's the character. He's the joker. And there's also this sense, and I think it has been overplayed slightly, but there is this sense that he's the key man. He's the guy Australia fear. And if he goes, and I can't help thinking, I take your point about Panesar, and the facts are there to back you up on that. But that being said, he's been out of international cricket for a while. He doesn't carry the fear factor, and suddenly England's advantage in the spin department goes, I think, to a considerable extent.
But having said that, I wonder how much of this is based mainly on sort of the image of Swan, and how much is actually the substance? Because the spin doctor rather than the spin bowler. That's good, isn't it? That's good. In the 2009 Ashes, and actually I was quite astounded when I read this, and it was in an article by Gideon Hayes, so he might just have been lying to try and put us all off. But Graham Swan in 2009 took 6 wickets in the first 4 tests, and England won the series.
I do take this point. He was not, and this is something that I've often come back to, he was not a real star in 2009. I would accept this, and I think this one thing that's kind of got forgotten, he's been excellent since, but it's actually kind of got forgotten, the fact that he never really stuck out. I mean, for me, his standout performance in that was actually this astonishing batting effort he had at Headingley when that test was lost, when he went ballistic with the bat.
Nathan Harris outbowled him consistently throughout the series.
All that being said, since that series, Swan's Swan's position in world cricket has risen and risen and risen. And his record against good quality batsmen as well. I mean, what he did in South Africa, for example, last winter, he's really shown that he can get good batsmen and get them consistently. And you just feel, given everything, he's the one bowler on either side at the moment who you really feel like will have, you can confidently feel he'll have a good yep. series.
He's also a very intelligent cricketer. He knows how to he knows what's needed from him at different times. He's actually, I think, he's underrated in the versatility of his bowling.
Well, and also, I mean, a lot's been said about the pressure, but I actually think we get the joker. Well, you know, if you are of that twittering type, you can follow the joker through his, you know, toothbrushing routine every morning if you wish. But aside from that, I think he's actually quite a wise old head. I mean, you've got a guy who was kicked out of Test cricket, kicked out of international cricket for such a long time, that for all of this time, he is living, you know, he really is living a career that he never expected to get back. And I think there is a toughness to him and an experience to him. I think he'll handle the conditions, and I think he'll have some fun. That's the good what if, the dream what if. We find ourselves at the Gabba. England win the toss. England have a bat. KP finds himself in, perhaps slightly earlier than he wants. Maybe yet another Alistair Cook has a couple of his, you know, cheeky fiddle outside off stump. And we have a runnable 100 from KP. Majestic stuff. The man plays himself into form. And suddenly, we have the old KP back. What happens next?
Well, I think a little bit like the Swan discussion, I think the conclusion of that was basically that this series is going to turn on individual performances. And I think if Ponting makes big runs for Australia, Australia will be in the driving seat. If Peterson makes big runs for England, England will be in the driving seat.
But if I took the position of super pessimism on Swan. I think if England lose Swan, they lose the series. It's interesting to say how strong you feel like with KP. I mean, you made the point Swan wasn't great in 2009. KP wasn't great in 2009. I mean, he wasn't there for most of it. I'll correct that.
Yep.
He was actually injured for that. So he definitely wasn't great. And you have the idea here that an England series, England were able to do it without him there. Can they do it again? The one thing, and I'm rather fond of this as a metaphor, the idea that you have plenty of solid workhorse kind of Peugeot Fords on either side, but there's only one Ferrari on either side, and that is Peterson.
Yep.
He has the ability.
And he's a game changer.
He is, and the ability to score quickly, the ability to score aggressively. You just feel like if he gets going, he can take the series away from Australia quite quick. But I mean, can you? I'm just curious. There is that school of thought that actually suggests his best days are behind him. Full stop. Like he's never. I mean, can you see him being?
I don't agree. And I think he's always been the kind of player who's never really actually settled into consistently big scores. He's never been the kind of person who you can point to 4 years in his career and say that was when Kevin Peterson was
the
great.
The KP golden age.
And I think he has still got a lot left in him. And I think part of the danger of him is that he's actually still got a lot to prove. And that, you know, since when you think that actually he made his debut in 2005. And that's actually, in a not that much cricket, in
I'll,
a sense, has
I'll,
happened.
I'll put this forward. If he has a starring series, if he averages, say, 50 plus, even, say, 60 plus, gets a couple of big hundreds, I think it seals him as a great. Like, you have a figure who, let's remember, his 150 saw England regain the Ashes after an endless wait.
Mm.
If he's the man who then helps England, get the Ashes, hold on to the Ashes in Australia, I think you have a situation where you are dealing with a real once-in-a-generation player.
And I think that's the kind of thing that motivates someone like Peterson.
I think he only gets out of bed for the prospect of being a player who deals in, you know, without wanting to stand against you, Clinch. I think he's a player who deals in notions
of greatness.
He deals in greatness, exactly.
Let's
get all Australian. The negative what if we have, and we touched on this, we have I was going to say an elderly Ricky Ponting, that's slightly harsh, an aging Ricky Ponting. He can't pull in the way, he can't play the pull shot in the way that he used to do. And
probably can't pull
in the way he used to do either. And he generally, I mean, if this is rather, this is slightly stretching it a touch. He didn't have a terrible series in India, but bear with me. He fails twice at Brisbane. Australia get hammered in the test. Suddenly, he finds himself really under pressure. This is a guy who, let's remember, has lost the Ashes twice. I mean, that's not, you know, that is pretty tough territory for any Australian captain to be in. I mean, how would he go forward into a second test with that? A defeat and a couple of failures behind him?
I think he'd go forward with a lot of trouble. I don't think for a minute that he'd even, you know, worst case scenario or best case scenario for an England fan, England win by 250 runs, which I don't think is going to happen at all. But say they do.
It could.
Yeah, it could. Everything's possible. And Ponting makes a pair, say. I think that probably the single most destructive thing to this Australia side would be to sack Ponting. For several reasons. Firstly, because I don't think there's actually anyone who can take his place.
There's not an obvious.
Northern Clark have both been touted as potential, but both frankly have struggled to hold their place in the side.
The Australia's love affair with Clark is if it was ever there, is firmly gone. Yeah. I don't think he's in any way a captain in waiting. All the rumours over North as captain, given his form and given the fact that he more than anyone looks set to be, you know, England's bunny over this series, seems odd. But I just bring the question up because I think if he fails, similar to if Ponting, if KP fails, it produces a hole in that England batting, in that Aussie batting lineup.
Yeah, I agree. It's an interesting Australian lineup because with all the batsmen, you get the sense that you're in with a chance of getting them out cheaply. But of all those batsmen, the one that you are most afraid of is Ponting.
Yeah, because, if he gets going.
Because that, at the moment there is that kind of, and it was the same in 2005 to an extent, apart from a couple of innings, that you either did get him pretty cheaply, you got him for an under 20, or he went on and made big runs. And I would be, actually, I mean, I think if I'm scared of, I'm sort of scared of two Australian players, and the next one we'll be moving on to
the next one we're going to move.
But Ponting, I think, is a man. We all know it's a man who is capable of making very big scores.
There was a great quote from Jason Gillespie recently. I think it was Jason Gillespie who said that Ponting is the one real tough nut on either of these two sides. And yep. I think there's something you said that I think mentally he is streets ahead of almost anyone else playing. He is a properly hardened cricketer, happy with his back against the wall. It'll be fascinating to see if he comes good here.
Absolutely.
Next what if, the dream what if. Mitchell Johnson suddenly gets the old menace back, gets more than the old menace back, and Australia find themselves with a Dennis Lilly figure on their hands, real aggression. And I mean, it's really the issue of how England then cope with that. I mean, do England have the wherewithal to cope with a properly fiery, you know, hitting the deck hard, getting a lot of bounce? How do they cope with a bowler who bowls with real venom?
Well, we were talking about the last time England faced properly quick bowling, which was in South Africa, this time last year.
Mixed results.
But also, and I mean, I'm not sure if I actually properly believe what I'm about to say, so bear with me. But I do wonder whether, actually, if you were to go through this England batting lineup and pick the weaknesses in all of the individual batsmen, it wouldn't necessarily be out and out pace that was the problem.
No, well, this is a fair point. I think we talked about the fact they went hosted Pakistan and actually had a pretty rough time. You know, won the series at a canter, but didn't have a particularly fun time against Pakistani bowlers swinging it around. You know,
only won it because the batsmen were so entirely
useless and against
picking out the right end of the bat,
the most inept batting lineup in recent Test history. And you have a bowler here who will offer them something entirely different. And I basically think that this is a bowling lineup that's been a touch underrated. I think I'm not so scared. I'm not going to get massively, you know, Ben Helfenhaus keeps very few people awake at night. But Mitchell Johnson might just, I mean, he has in terms of unfinished business as well, post 2009.
Absolutely.
He has sort of serious previous here.
He does. I think he's one of those players who, if he performs really well, it'll be a bonus for Australia. But yet, I just feel that Australia will perform well if he doesn't perform amazingly. His performing amazingly will be a bonus. Whereas what we were saying about Peterson, for instance, is that the whole team will. You know, the whole performance will be better if Peterson performs. You know, the whole team depends on Peterson, but I don't think the whole team depends on Johnson.
Maybe I'll be made to eat my words after Xavier Doherty runs through England on the first day at Brisbane. But he's the only bowler I can see in that Australian team who I can see doing real damage, like a kind of, you know, England find themselves 100-odd for six, yep. Johnson's taken a fiver. He's the one bowler I can see doing that. And I think, you know, he's the one bowler who Strauss must feel. I mean, Cook as well. I mean, frankly, Cook can get worried about anyone at the moment. But I think, you know, Cook will not find that a pleasant experience, Johnson and the new ball.
Is this a moment to move? We must
plunder confidently on to the next very exciting segment, which we promise we won't keep going much longer. This is a bumper edition, however, we've got a very brief list of things that have possibly been misunderstood.
Andy was up all night thinking of that catchy title.
It was a catchy title. I went for concise and. Things that we've had a lot of build-up, probably too much build-up, and a couple of things that we think have been over-talked about. Let's be mental and go to what's on the bottom of the list and talk about this idea, the obsession with tall bowlers. We have 2 6-foot-8ers, a 6'5" in Stuart Broad, and even, you know, James Anderson coming in at a 6'2".
6'2", which is coincidentally the same height as Mitchell Johnson, we discovered earlier.
So England have already won the battle of height.
They've already won the battle of height, and I think, and actually, it relates to something else that we put on the list of things that might have been misunderstood, which is the Kookaburra ball. I just wonder whether, after having spent 5 seconds on the first one, I just wonder whether England's obsession with height is a little bit misleading, actually, and the fact that Tremnett was picked ahead of Shahzad for that sort of reserve.
He's had a
pace
decent
bowling.
Time of it so far, hasn't he?
But it's a fairly samey bowling attack. Really.
It seems to be based for sort of international coaching on a quite simplistic notion. Let's sort of bomb it in short with tall people.
Yeah, right. The pitches are suited to pace, therefore we have to bowl pace. And it's the same, I think, as this idea of the Kookaburra ball. And I have this theory that this idea that the Kookaburra ball won't do any, you know, if you don't take wickets before it's three, you bowl three balls with it, you're never going to. And I think, in a sense, that's actually just been based on the fact that, you know, when Darren Goth and Andy Carter used to go out there, they used to bowl up, serve up half volleys, a yard and a half outside off stump. And England would wonder why they were 350
for 1. Before coming on air, we were chatting about this idea that actually, you look back at Australia's most recent series, the West Indies have gone there and taken wickets, Pakistan have gone there and taken wickets. I mean, it's not sort of important. And obviously, Australia have taken wickets. You know, the Kookaburra ball is not this kind of... You get the idea that it's almost sort of you're bowling with this kind of unhelpful sort of
sponge bag.
Yeah, that this sort of unbowlable. And, you know, it will do. The idea that it will swing less than in England is hardly a sort of news headline. We were going to talk a bit about England's strength, Australia's weaknesses. I mean, I think to cover that in brief, we've covered a lot of it already.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm being vaguely pessimistic about this, that we've got a little bit carried away with how good this England team is and a little carried away with how bad this Australia team is.
I agree entirely, and I think the Australians have lost a lot of form, but I think fundamentally a lot of those players are fantastically good players, and I think they, for you know, that skill and their quality will shine through.
Might just shine through. Well, that's we don't want to end it on a pessimistic note. I mean, I
so
think
let's give our Ashes predictions then before we start.
Well, I mean, I wondered, you obviously want to finish the podcast on a strong note. I thought we could finish on an epic debate over Xavier Doherty versus Nathan Horwitz, which is obviously
that's not going to keep me here
for
much longer.
That is the question on everyone's lips. Okay, Ashes predictions. I'd rather you went first, actually.
Okay, I'm going to predict a I think I'm going to predict a 1-1 draw, England retaining the Ashes.
Ooh, a 1-1 draw. That is very... I'm going to actually... on the side of optimism? I'm going to go on the side of optimism. I was going to say a 2-1 draw. I'm going to say a 2-1 England victory. I think... I agree. I read a Jonathan Agnew thing recently. If we're ever going to win it there again, it's hard to see us ever having a better shot than this. So let's, you know, go on, lads, etc.
Yeah, exactly.
I noticed on the Crick Info counter before we went on air, I think we're 2 days and 2 hours away. I'll certainly be burning the midnight oil.
Isn't it?
But
yeah.
Thank you very much for staying with us. This has been a truly bumper episode, and we will be back with you, hopefully with good news.
Yeah.
In 2 weeks' time.